Judges chapter 3 and beginning at verse 12. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He gathered to himself the Ammonites and the Amalekites and went and defeated Israel. And they took possession of the city of palms. And the people of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, for 18 years. Then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord, and the Lord raised up for them a deliverer, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. The people of Israel sent tribute by him to Eglon, the king of Moab. And Ehud made for himself a sword with two edges, a cubit in length, and he bound it on his right thigh under his clothes. And he presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now Eglon was a very fat man. And when Ehud had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people who carried the tribute. But he himself turned back at the idols near Gilgal and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. And he commanded, silence. And all his attendants went out from his presence. And Ehud came to him as he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber. And Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. And he arose from his seat. And Ehud reached with his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh and thrust it into his belly. And the hilt also went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not pull the sword out of his belly, and the excrement came out. Then Ehud went out into the porch and closed the doors of the roof chamber behind him and locked them. When he had gone, the servants came, and when they saw that the doors of the roof chamber were locked, they thought, surely he is relieving himself in the closet of the roof chamber. And they waited till they were embarrassed. But when he still did not open the doors of the roof chamber, they took the key and opened them. And there lay their Lord, dead, on the floor. Ehud escaped while they delayed, and he passed beyond the idols and escaped to Sarah. When he arrived, he sounded the trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim. Then the people of Israel went down with him from the hill country, and he was their leader. And he said to them, follow after me, for the Lord has given your enemies, the Moabites, into your hand. So they went down after him and seized the fords of the Jordan against the Moabites and did not allow anyone to pass over. And they killed at that time about 10,000 of the Moabites, all strong, able-bodied men. Not a man escaped. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest for 80 years. The passage we just read from Judges 3 is a joke. It's a comedy. And what I'm going to do in a second is explain the joke, which, as you know, works really well across languages, but you're still going to find it funny, I almost promise. But first, let me orient us on where we are in history. We're in the book of Judges. That means that God has given Israel the land of Palestine. They have gone in. They have begun the conquest. They haven't finished it, and they're locked in a series of skirmishes, to try and clear out the land from God's enemies. And chapter 2, right before this, summarizes the plot of the whole book like this. Israel turns from Yahweh and starts serving idolatrous gods. As a result, God gives them over into the hands of their enemies. They lose their battles. They end up serving not just these idols, but enemy kings as well. After a while, the covenant Lord, Yahweh, raises up an Israelite deliverer, a judge, to save the people. And while he lives, all is well. And as soon as he dies, Israel forgets Yahweh again, the covenant Lord, goes back to idols, and the cycle begins. And you get a ton of these cycles. And right at the beginning of the book, Judges tells you that's what's going to keep on happening. And right here, we're in the second cycle. Beginning of chapter 3, Othniel was the first judge, Ehud is the second. But it's a comedy. We've sung Psalm 2. What does God do in the face of rebels who are against him? Sometimes he laughs because they're so pathetic. And in this passage, he's giving us that perspective of one of the things that's true about God's enemies is that they're laughable. And we get to sit in the throne room of heaven and look down on history with the perspective of the God who is so frightened of his enemies that he just laughs at them. He's given us this passage in the Bible so that we can share God's relaxed, confident laughter about history. So, like I say, jokes never translate well across languages, so I'm going to give you a ton of "this is what the Hebrew says." Now, please don't make that cause you but to burn your English Bibles. There's nothing wrong with the translation you've got, whether it's the ESV, the NIV, the King James, or any of the others I'm not going to list. They all translate the plot of this judge absolutely spot on perfectly. There's nothing I want to change, but you can't translate the puns, the allusions, the double entendres. And that's what I'm going to try and get you to see, because that shows you how you should enjoy the passage, not just what went on in history. You with me? Great. So let's kick off. The first thing, in verse 15, you get there, Ehud, the judge, is a Benjamite, a left-handed man. Now, Benjamin means a son of the right hand. So there's your first clue that you're going to have a load of puns. He's a son of the right hand, but he's bound in the right hand. He's left-handed. Okay, that's your author's signal that, okay, I'm going to do some fun here in this passage. And the basic comedy you're going to get is that King Eglon is a sacrifice on God's altar, and Ehud is the priest offering that sacrifice. Those are the overtones that you get when you look at the language being used. So, for instance, again in verse 15, we're told that Ehud was given tribute. Well, it is tribute in the context, but it's an offering. It's a sacrifice. And we're told that it's given by the people by Ehud, through him. Well, it's through his hand. Now, why does that matter? Well, when God tells Moses to consecrate priests, he tells them this: "And you shall put the robes on Aaron your brother and on his sons with him, and you shall anoint them, and you shall fill their hand," which our version translates as "ordain them. And then you shall consecrate them, and they may serve me as priests." Ehud here is being ordained as a priest and is being given a sacrificial offering for the tabernacle. What's next? Eglon. Well, if you're an Israelite, you know full well that the Hebrew Eglah means a calf, a heifer, a young cow. And that exactly the same letters with slightly different vowels mean robust, rotund, round, cuddly. His name already tells you that he's probably some sort of fattened calf, ready for a slaughter, as you'd expect. And then we're told, to make the point, he's a very fat man. But the word for fat there is really unusual. Up until this point in the Bible, it's occurred 6 times, all of them in Pharaoh's dreams. Do you remember the dreams? "And I saw 7 animals that are really skinny and 7 animals that were really fat." This word. What were the animals, please? Someone tell me. Cows. You with me? He's a fattened cow, a calf, a heifer, ready for the slaughter. Now, I should say, in what sense is the fact that he's fat part of the comedy? I'm not in the habit of making fat jokes, as you can probably tell. If I weren't wearing a corset, the small children would run hiding. If you saw my dad and my older brothers, you'd know that our family motto is, "Why have a six-pack when you could have a barrel?" But it's funny because of that sense of being fattened for the slaughter, and it's funny because you don't expect mighty warrior kings, and as we'll see later, all of their armies, to be on the stout side. You expect them to be lean, mean fighting machines. So, here is Ehud, a freshly consecrated priest, holding a sacrificial offering, packing a dagger, as we've seen, hidden about him, and he presents the tribute, and yes, that is how I would translate it, but it is the word that you always get when a priest presents an offering in the tabernacle or the temple. And there you've got a fattened calf, just ready for slaughter. And then in the next verse again, in verse 18, he presents the tribute. That's just a classic sacrificial tabernacle phrase. So in verse 19, when Ehud says, "I have a secret message," the word there for message is mildly ambiguous. It can mean a word or it can mean a thing. And as a Hebrew reader, you know full well that what I've got is a secret thing, a sword for you. But you also know that Eglon, Fat King Eglon, is going to have to decide. Am I being offered a thing, or am I being offered a message, perhaps some information from this loyal subject? And we see that he does choose. What does Fat King Eglon say? Silence. Very well, then. You don't want a word. Have a thing. Okay? And he doesn't actually say silence. He says hush. The Hebrew there is has. Okay, he's a cow. He can't really speak. He can't produce three-syllable words. He just comes out with noises, and that's the only thing he says in this entire passage. He's just offering himself for the slaughter. So don't think of Ehud as a particularly cunning savior. Just realize that Fat King Eglon and his bodyguards who've left him alone are dimwits. They're pathetic. They're ridiculous. That's the whole point of what's going on here. You don't, if you're in the royal bodyguard, say, oh, you haven't got a secret weapon concealed on your left thigh as though you were right-handed. I'm not going to bother to frisk you on the right thigh. And then I'm going to leave you alone with the king. Okay, that's really very stupid, pathetic. So, and again in verse 20, we're reminded of that. Ehud had come to the king Eglon while King Eglon was all alone, all on his tod. Brilliant. Well done, the secret service. And at this point, Ehud changes the message. It's no longer, I have a secret message. I have a message from, not from Yahweh, but a message from God, which causes, you know, King Blubber to rise in respect, which of course exposes the target area rather nicely, and Ehud can, you know, go right for the bullseye. At which point, in verse 22, the excrement comes out, the dung comes out. Again, a really unusual word, peresh. Up until here, every time it happens in the Bible, it's when the priests are being taught how to deal with the different parts of a sacrificed animal. The skin, the flesh, the fat, and the excrement. And it's always of a bull or a heifer. The theme of Eglon, the fat cow, just continues. He really is a heifer being offered on the altar of Yahweh by an Israelite priest. And even though our translations, for good reasons, don't say it, you get the word fat there twice in that verse. So, look at Eglon. Of what does the might of Moab consist? What is King Eglon made of? What is the glory of Moab? Well, only two things, fat and feces. Blubber and bowel movement. Cellulite and cesspit. Thunder thighs and toilet, right there, side by side. There is your mighty king. There is this great threat that subjugated you, O Israel, for 18 years. Ehud then makes good his escape. And in verse 24, the comedy really gets going. We know there was a latrine above because they tell us this. So the servants, when they smell this dung that has come out going through the door, they assume that the king is doing his business as they're used to smelling when they're on the other side of this locked door. But then in verse 25, they waited. Now, the reason every translation says waited is that what the Hebrew really says doesn't seem to make sense. So they change the Hebrew. But if you get that it's a joke, that it's a comedy, it makes perfect sense. What the Hebrew says is they writhed like a woman in labor. Doesn't that make sense? Here are these cracked bodyguards on the other side of the door going, oh, who will save us from the mighty bowel movements of King Blubber? Oh no, the smell, the stench of it. Can you remember last time three tiles fell off the roof at the movement and killed my camel? You know, and you can imagine the officer saying, no, you must maintain dignity for his royal majesty. But sergeant, it's unbearable. What, you know, they're just clowns. They're pathetic. These are the enemies that have been subduing Israel for 18 years, writhing on the other side of the door because their king is so fat that when he goes to the potty, the world moves. And, you know, you get to the end of the verse, and there's this lovely comedic flash freeze frame, five words. Look, their Lord, fallen, grounded, dead. It's the end of the might of Moab. And then the comedy is sort of done by then. If we fast forward to verse 28... you see there that Follow after me, for Yahweh has given your enemies, the Moabites, into your hand. He hasn't given the Moabites into my hand. He has given them into your hand. Remember that filling the hand is how you consecrate a priest. Israel were meant to be a nation of priests. And just as Ehud has become a priest and offered the king as a sacrifice, now the whole of Israel is a priestly nation and is about to offer 10,000 Moabites as their sacrifice. And in the next verse, 29, they killed at that time about 10,000 of the Moabites, all strong, able-bodied men. Strong and able-bodied. In other words, God has done this, right? But at the same time, the word for strong, literally, it's oily. And the word for able-bodied looks an awful lot like the word for writhing. Just to remind you of fat King Eglon and his blithering, writhing bodyguards on the other side of the door. That as Ehud was given the victory, so here, the rest of Israel. So, what are we to make of this? Well, if the Moabites are so pathetically comical, then how on earth did they have Israel under their thumb for 18 whole years? Because there was nothing funny about this at the time, was there? The king is fat and his men are fat. Yeah, of course, because they're eating our food. Where's the comedy as that? Well, we know how it happened. Verse 12. It was Yahweh's doing. The Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done what was evil. So this comedy is also a warning. If Yahweh, the covenant Lord, is against his people, then the most pathetic enemy is too strong for them. But when Yahweh blesses his people, then the most mighty enemy is too weak for us. See, we are never, ever more secure than when we have nothing on our side than Jesus and his promises. We are never, but never more secure than when we have absolutely nothing on our side except Jesus Christ and his good promises. And really the passage keeps making this point that it's all about worshipping idols and turning from idols and God blessing. So in verse 12, you see there that Yahweh strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel. Yeah, kind of literally it's over Israel. And throughout the passage, I'm not going to show you every time it happens, but you get this over-under thing. As Moab is over Israel, and then when Yahweh intervenes, he lifts up Ehud as a deliverer, and then Israel is over Moab. So in verse 18, where we have there, and when Ehud had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people who carried the tribute. I reckon another way of reading that would be, he freed the people who had suffered the burden of raising the offering. In other words, he delivered Israel from Eglon, and I am about to tell you how he did it, says the author. It's not sent away the people carrying this offering. It's, look, here's how he delivered Israel. And the fact they're raising the offering means they're under Moab, right? So verse 19, but he himself turned back at the idols near Gilgal. I think that is unhelpful. I think it actually is. I think he had already turned back, not at the idols, from the idols. What's the first step in delivering Israel? It's turning from idols. Simply stop serving them. And then go and deliver Israel. And in verse 20, you see it again. When Ehud had come to King Eglon, while King Eglon was in the roof chamber, in the upper room. And you see that King Blubber here rises in respect, not for the true God, but for the mention of any old God. And he arose from being above his throne. And that's the last time in the story that a Moabite is above anything, or above anyone. So that upper room, you see it again in verse 23, in verse 24, and then verse 25. How does Eglon end? He's fallen down. Then Ehud goes, and he passed beyond the idols. Well, usually that word would mean to cross the idols. And in Judges, we've had that verb once before. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, And he said, because this people have crossed, have transgressed my covenant that I commanded their fathers. So what is Ehud doing to the idols? He's transgressing them. He's crossing them. He's disrespecting them. He's blowing their nose at them. He's publicly turning the whole nation away from them. And as soon as he does that, Israel ends up over Moab, which you can see, because when the Israelites follow Ehud, their leader, they have to go down. Do you see it there in verse 17? Then the people of Israel went down with him from the hill country. And again, in the next verse, they go down. And Ehud knows what's happened. It's the Lord, Yahweh, who has given the Moabites into their hand. And the people go down onto the Moabites. They even go to the river Jordan. And the word Jordan means the down river, because the valley is so steep. To get to the water, you have to go down, and so the Yarden is the down river. What was up has become down, because one man turned from idols, because Yahweh lifted him up. And not one man was allowed to cross over, or maybe to cross, to transgress. And how does the story end? Verse 30. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel. So let's just remember how this all got started. Verse 12. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And he tells us that twice in that passage. They did evil in the eyes of the Lord, so the Lord raised up fat King Eglon because they had done evil in the eyes of the Lord. And I find that little comment really scary, because as you read through the book, you get to the end of the book of Judges, and it tells you this. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was good in his own eyes. You can be doing what you think is good, but be doing evil in the eyes of the Lord, because there was no king in Israel. No king in Israel? Well, what about Eglon? What about all the other foreign invading kings? What about Abimelech and the other tin pot banana republic dictators who raised themselves up within Israel to be kings? Now, the problem is that the Lord was meant to be the king, and he was not the king. Do you remember, as we've gone through 1 Samuel in the evenings, when Samuel is told by the people, we want a king because your children are scoundrels, and he goes to the Lord, and the Lord says, don't take it personally. It's not you, Samuel, whom they've rejected as king. It's me, the Lord, whom the people have rejected as king. So I really think it would be a lot less scary if this story had started with everyone did what was evil in his own eyes, or if the book ended with everyone did what was evil in his own eyes. But it's not. They were clueless. As you read through the book, you get this clueless sense that the Israelites are committing idolatry, they're raping each other, they're murdering each other, they're doing all sorts of things, and all of it seemingly with a good conscience. But they're worshipping idols. They're sinning terribly. And it took them, in this passage, 18 years to even think to pray, to cry out to the Lord and be rescued. And how long did it take the Lord? Once he heard one prayer saying, you are our God, please save us, immediately. Next thing you hear is, Ehud, up you come, and that's the end of the Moabites, pretty much, bar one sharpened double-edged sword and, you know, a couple of bodyguards taken care of. The people didn't know what was good or evil. They didn't know their left hand from their right, because they were serving idols. And I just wonder whether we're always as different from them as I would love to hope. Because I think the big idol of our age is secular humanism. And I'm not sure that I don't bow the knee to that idol more often than I think I ought to. Because what humanism does is to say, instead of following Jesus, I will allow you to practice the Christian religion. I will draw a box called religion, and you may pack into that box whatever religion you like, and they're all equal in my eyes. And so our charities law, dating back to Elizabethan times, used to recognize the promotion of religion, meaning the one true Protestant evangelical religion which has no rival. Now it has come to mean the promotion of whatever you can stuff into this box, be it Rastafarianism, which seems to be sort of smoking pot but with better music, or Jedi Knights, which people in New Zealand are putting on their, you know, forms to try and get themselves recognized. Now, you agree with me that that's wrong, right? That following Jesus isn't one option among many, that Jesus isn't an authority under the state, that we know what's right and wrong, not because the Bible is right for us, but because the Bible is true, full stop, because it's Jesus' final word. But I think I see, certainly in my life, but I'm going to start with a more sympathetic example, examples of us bowing down to this idol of humanism that says, please will you keep your religion inside here? I hope you'll be sympathetic to this example while also realizing, actually, no, that is idolatry. Lots of you are involved in a great, great, great project, which I'm not about to criticize, don't sweat, called the Heritage School, right? A Christian school. Some of you are students there, or teachers, or parents. And it won't surprise you to know that there's an organization that wants to shut you down, right? Of course there is. Wants to shut down every Christian school in the country. Might surprise you to know that it's a Christian organization that wants to shut down every Christian school in the country. Not a Christian organization, but the kind that we here pray for and give money to. Why? Because they're terrified of the rise of Islam. They're terrified of Muslims being allowed to have faith schools and radicalizing their children and forming ghettos. And the only alternative that these guys can see is, dear state, please ban all religious education. Please will you force everybody, including us, to hand our children to you. See, it's living in this world where every religion gets a place at the table, and above the table sits humanism saying, you can do what you want. Now, I've got a lot of sympathy with that fear, because, you know, the guys running this organization have fled from Islamic persecution. They've got a fatwa against their head. They're not cowards. They're not fools. But it seems to me they've bought into this idea that what is safe in the end is the state over religions. And as Ian has been reminding us on Sunday mornings in Matthew's Gospel, that was the issue for the early church, right? What was the rock against Christians stumbled? It was Caesar ipse dixit. Caesar himself has spoken, and that was a thing which you were not allowed to disagree with. To which Jesus replies, well, no, actually, the highest legal principle, if we're going to have a Latin fest, is quia ego sic dico, which when translated means, because I say so. That's the bottom line in every argument for a Christian, because Jesus says so, and we don't need to ask anybody's permission to say that that is the final authority. Rome was packed full of different religions. You could pick any religion you wanted, and there would be no trouble. But why were Christians persecuted? They wouldn't worship Caesar. Caesar would have been quite happy to have Christians worshiping Jesus and him, and Christians said, no, sorry, it's only Jesus, not you. Caesar would have been quite happy to have Jesus as a god, but not Jesus as a king. These people preach another king. Remember the thing that the Jews are trying to tell the Romans, go and get these guys? That's the issue. It's not religion, it's who's the highest authority. No, it's not Caesar. Yes, it is Jesus. He's not the number two in the life of the church. He's the number one, publicly so. That's what Satan offers Jesus in the wilderness, isn't it? Look at all these nations. I've got authority over them. I will give you all of them if you will only worship me. I will make you executive vice president in charge of absolutely everything, so long as you just right now bow down to me and prove that I have the number one spot and you have the number two spot. And Jesus said no. And Ehud said no to Yahweh being under Eglon. And the people went with Ehud and won the battle and mopped up. Jesus struck the blow against Satan, and his people with him, we've been mopping up ever since. And that's why the apostles were so joyful, relaxed, cheerful about persecution. In Acts, if you try and tell the apostles to stop preaching this gospel, they just ignore you. And when you beat them, they sing about it. And they're delighted. Why? Because they're used to singing Psalm 2. They know that Jesus is winning. They're used to singing Psalm 110. They know that Jesus is just waiting until the Father makes every last enemy a footstool for his feet. What is King Eglon right now? He's a particularly comfy bit of Jesus' footstool. That's all there is to him. There should be no question of listening to anyone who says that Jesus can be number two in our lives in exchange for some protection. We don't need that. And when I look at the letters I've signed in the last round of political lobbying, I wonder if I've had that perspective. I don't think I have. I think if I'd had that perspective, I'd have been wanting to sign letters and petitions that said things like, hey, I believe this because Jesus is Lord. Hey, you know what? Thus saith the Lord. Hey, you know what? I don't think that redefining marriage is merely unnecessary because civil partnerships already do the job. I actually think civil partnerships are wrong because Jesus says so. And that's why I'm against this thing too. And, you know, if I win this one, don't worry, I'm going to keep rolling the clock back on you. I'm not a reasonable man by your definition of reasonableness. I'm a zealot. I'm a follower of King Jesus. I mean, that's how you'll be seen, no matter how politely you put it, right? And that's why I haven't said that, because I'm embarrassed about it. But that's the perverse thing about idolatry, that idols accept your worship and then they start hurting you and then you turn to the very same idol for protection. Israel worshipped the idols of Moab. So the Moabite king oppressed them. So they carried on worshipping the idols of Moab for 18 years in the hope of something better. So I wonder whether we're not more to blame for the redefinition of marriage than we might like to think. I wonder whether if we go back to the last political battle, we might notice that, hey, what did we appeal to as the final authority? Free speech and human rights. And please let us have a place at the table marked religions instead of, hey, let us declare to you the final authority of Jesus. I wonder whether we need to ask Jesus to save us from humanism. Jesus, who raised up Ehud, and Ehud turned from idols. And after Eglon died, all the people turned from idols and mopped up the battle. Jesus, who turned away from Satan's idolatrous offer, who bled on the cross, who died for our sins, and after he defeated Satan at that cross, has been sitting at the right hand of the Father, waiting for total victory, for unconditional surrender. And I think that perspective matters because it means we don't need to be afraid of our enemies. Which is what Jesus tells us when we stand up for his truth. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? And not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. But even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows. And right away he says, so everyone who acknowledges me before men, I also will acknowledge before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I also will deny before my Father who is in heaven. Now, if we have that perspective of a Father who counts the hairs on our head, of a Son who already has the victory and is just waiting for it all to be mopped up, whether we might relax about our enemies, whether we might be quicker to love our enemies, whether we might maybe even have a sense of humor, because it seems to me we're heading for the kind of lobbying that ends up with people telling the joke, how many Christians does it take to change a light bulb? That's not funny. Okay, we're just becoming the next bunch of people ready to be offended at the drop of a hat. Did you notice in the press, the Archbishop got an angry lobbying letter from a gay activist and replied saying, thank you for your letter, why don't you come by for tea? And the gay activist just didn't know what to do. This had never happened to him. How have we got to that point where somebody as pathetic as a 40-year-old toddler on a permanent temper tantrum demanding his rights, somebody who is clearly a lost sheep, we're so afraid of him that we don't talk to him? How has that happened? It can't be because we spent too long meditating on the perspective of the laughing God who has already won the victory. But we have this laughing God who killed Eglon, who wrote about it, who made sure it was in the Bible for us so that we could laugh with him, so we could have his perspective on the battle we're fighting. A battle not against flesh and blood, to be sure, but nonetheless a battle that ends with, at the name of Jesus, every knee shall bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. We're not in any danger of losing. Jesus is not in any danger of losing. We're on the winning side. We've picked the right team. And if you're not on that team, switch sides. It's a no-brainer. We're about to sing about this. Jesus shall reign wherever the Son does his successive journeys run. His kingdom will stretch from shore to shore till moons shall wax and wane no more. Let's stand and sing together.